Louis, it was so nice to have your daughter Christina here last time. We were able to learn so much about her work with the Songhees First Nations and about her degree that she's just finishing and then going on to do her master's and the research and the policy that she's working on. It's so exciting that it kind of got us talking afterwards about how when Tsleil-Waututh people leave the reserve and go off to discover other parts of the world, how that affects Tsleil-Waututh culture and how it affects their learning and their experience. So that was an interesting conversation about being on reserve, off reserve, and then returning to the reserve, the effects of the reserve on the culture. So let's talk about that today.
Yeah, well, you know, it never realized, it never dawned on me what influence I had on her lifestyle, you know, and it goes to show you that kids will actually pay attention, you know, when you think they're not. And it was kind of a shock to me, you know, because I, you know, they're always in the background. I never really thought that they were actually listening. So, you know, it's a feeling of, I guess, kind of an accomplishment, you know, to say, well, I tried doing my daddy part. Yeah, but I've always stressed to the young people, go out into the real world and learn. Because sooner or later, you know, when they get older, they seem to, a lot of our people seem to come back to the reserve, you know, come back home. And I always remind them, get out there in the real world and learn. Because the more you learn, the more you bring back to the reserve and make it a better place.
So what make people went everywhere. Your harvesting processes, your, you know, winter and summer homes, your, like, this idea of the reserve was very limiting to the culture. So
limiting it. I always tell people, you know, it's like they put a big fence around us, you know, and we were told to stay on there, feels like it, you know, and that is the way of our people now, you know, what they're kind of really obedient or something, you know, not aggressive enough, or I don't know. So I think that because our people traveled out throughout the land, you know, for centuries, getting to know the land and understanding it. Then when the government came in, they said, well, we're putting you on a reserve, you know, because they've done this right out through North and South America, limiting our travel. And it's like if you go off the reserve, you're not an Indian anymore. So I think that was part of it, you know, that losing your status was a big thing to our people. It means you don't have a family, kind of, so to speak, you know, and you're left to roam the, just like banishment from the tribe. I think that's what made it scared for the people to lose their status, because banishment is the old way of, if you've done something really bad, you're banished from the band, you're left to wander all over the land by yourself. And if the band seen you roaming around, they know you did something bad. Our people were scared of that disentitlement. So it's similar to banishment. You know, they were expecting to go out there and then travel all over the world. And with no band, you're not a Tsleil-Waututh anymore. And I think that was one of the reasons why our people were scared of that, losing their status. Slowly, I think people are, the government, kind of understanding now. And because a lot of times they threaten banishment. If you graduated from school, you lost your status. Or if you're in the army, you lost your status. So there's a lot of ways they had of threatening our status. So I think that's what really is part and parcel of what they were talking about. And I think I gave you the reason why I think our people were scared of that loss of status. Mm-hmm. But now I think it's a little bit different. More and more of our young people are slowly getting their higher education now without losing their status.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so my girl Christina was, you know, really brought out some thoughts on it. Because, you know, reserves are like a prison. You know, they built fence around our reserves. The government said, no, you can. We didn't really tell us, no, you can't go out and hunt and gather anymore, but they made it, put up barriers where we couldn't. You know, they allocated how much fish you can get, or even shut it off completely, or you couldn't even go out and off the reserve to hunt or gather anymore, because if you shot a deer off reserve, you were charged. So, you know, these were kind of things that stopped our people from going off reserve, because that fear of maybe losing their status. And now they do all their hunting and gathering now at Walmart, Askew's, Frills, you name it. That's where they do all their hunting and gathering now. Not only that, I keep reminding people too that all our salmon are gone, all our game is gone, all our plants are gone, all our trees are gone, you name it. Our water is disappearing. So is this the legacy that we're leaving our young people?
Well, right. That's the thing I'm interested in learning about, is how the culture is getting relearned and taught to the young people when so much of that has been lost because of the land-based knowledge that's being lost when there's been such a shrinkage of the land that you've been on.
I know, because, you know, it was taken away from us. You know, our culture, it was deep-rooted in us for centuries. And there are so many gaps in our culture now. You know, they call me a knowledge keeper, but I find there are so many gaps in our culture. How do you explain something that's gone, you know, especially to our young people? You know, and you look at the residential school and the education and the lack of learning their language and their culture. And I find that it's really difficult for the young people to really understand what is our culture? Who are we as Suwapma? And I think that's a big question. But I think that, are we adapting to the new way of life? And we're forgetting about who we are, you know, just a constant reminder once in a while, oh, you're Suwapma. You're one of the first people here. But how important is that? So it's a question that sometimes I wonder about. Sure, we're the first people here, but, you know, we helped early settlers survive in the land. We helped each other out. But once they learned our ways or learned the ways of the land, then they forgot about us. And I think that's a sad part of it. How do we still support each other? With some, you know, they keep saying, well, we got to go back to the traditional way and learn some answers of what's happening to the environment. But how can you teach something that was taken away from us? You know, there are dribs and drabs of it now. But to me, it's about how do you bring back some of the culture?
After seven generations of it being taken, lost, and broken, the family structure is broken. Yeah, how do you fill in those gaps? Is that maybe something that you talked about before, about leaving the reserve in order to go and experience other cultures to help try to fill in those gaps? Is that the adaptability that you're talking about?
Well, I think to me, maybe the adaptability is about the new way of life now and bring in ever what good things we have from our culture that we could remember and incorporate that into our governance system if we ever develop our own governance system. I'm thinking that, you know, it's like religion, you know, that was imposed on us. It might have been a good thing for some people, but it wasn't for all our people, you know, because it stripped them of their identity, you know, of who they are. And that's what I keep reminding other people, you know, that don't impose your religion on us, because it was imposed on our people for a few hundred years now. And look what it did to our people. Because when you read Tate's book, the early traders or the guides from back east were scared, told our people, watch out for the black robes. They're a coyote in disguise. If you listen to them, you'll become poor and needy. And look what happened to us, you know, and to our people. And so there's a lot of truth in what they told us first, you know, the priests, and, you know, they're imposing their religion on us. So anyways, we're kind of getting away from the off-reserve, on-reserve.
Well, and that's part of it, though, too, right? That the adapting to the spirituality through forceful, you know, like the indoctrination. Mm-hmm. But it's all part of that cultural, the hope for cultural renaissance, trying to fill in those gaps. So I understand that it's the spirituality, it's the language, it's the practices, the understanding of plants and animals, seasons, all of that is together. Mm-hmm. the things that you would have passed on through families and through community. And so much of that has been broken. How to relearn it on reserve, how to relearn it in a small, what in your words, like the prison, the fenced in space that didn't allow for actual Sahuatmec cultural practice. How do you reclaim that?
Well, I think it's the people have to learn their culture, you know, the basic. I think that that's a beginning to start understanding who we were as Sahuatmec. So once they start learning the basics, and then I think it'll gradually take root and maybe start expressing themselves a little more, because it's hard for the people to get off the reserve, and it's hard for people to come on reserve because, you know, that fear of each other. Maybe they might get to know us if they came on reserve.
It's true. There's, like, I think part of it's because of the big no trespassing signs that I think settlers think, well, then I'm not welcome here. And this is, you know, these are just the rules of the reserve. So, of course, like, there's just that understanding. But you, over the years, have taught me that the no trespassing is just for people that are doing bad things. Otherwise, you know, we should be talking to each other and attending events and helping build understanding and bridges.
Well, that's the most difficult part, because you don't see any of our people coming out into the community very often, you know, because they were scared that they might be laughed at or, you know, ridiculed or, you know, that shame maybe. It's really a difficult question to answer, because I've noticed it a long time. I know I'm one of the few that come out of the community into the other community and get a better understanding as to what's going on. And I think it's sharing of what little knowledge I have really helps the people, you know, to getting, because I always was a practitioner of saying, well, we got to get to know each other, otherwise we won't have that truth and reconciliation. And that's what it's all about, is getting to know one another. You see all the problems they're having now about land claim, title and rights, and things like that, because nobody talks to each other. You know, we brag about the communication that we have, you know, all rapid communication, but yet we still don't talk to each other, to understand each other. So it's a funny world we live in, you know. And
we can't deny the fact that racism plays a huge part in the level of engagement between settler and Indigenous communities, right? Like when you come into Salmon Arm, you're Louis Thomas. Like, everybody knows you. And you're the knowledge sharer that is the most generous and thoughtful and kind-hearted person that we know. But really, a lot of Indigenous people do not get that welcome in this community. So that's another bridge, I guess, that we have to be working on and making sure that racism is not the thing that is keeping people away.
I know. I don't think you could ever really eradicate racism, you know. It's so embedded in us, you know. Even we're guilty of that too, I guess. We, otherwise we'd be communicating with each other, you know. Our people would be talking to the city, and the city would be talking to us. And I think that with our education with our younger people, I think it's going to make a big difference. They have a way of communicating, because they broadens their minds, I think, and better understanding of the world out there. And to me, that's the most important aspect. But I always encourage them not to forget their roots. You know, that's what's the most important thing, is learning their roots through research. Because I think a lot of our young people are slowly starting to adapt to the new way of life now. And I've seen a lot of them try coming back to the reserve with their ideas, but the old ways are so embedded on the reserve now, it's really difficult to come in and say, well, here's the changes you got to make. And it's hard for the learned scholars, or whatever you want to call them, to come back on the reserve and start demanding or dictating to the people, because they're used to one way of life. And to make changes overnight, you know, I've seen too many the young people get discouraged and end up going back off the reserve and making their living off reserve. So it's coming back and learning how to work with your people, I think, is important. And how do you make them understand that there's a change coming, And I think Tina and people like that, you know, the mother, daughter, Crystal, you know, it's like that, you know, it's hard to change the people, you know, overnight. It's a slow process, and I've seen that myself through all the years I've been on council. And it's trying to understand your people more and what makes them tick. And I think that it's coming, but it's a slow process, I think, and because off-reserve is totally different than on-reserve. There are changes coming. I could see it now because we've been under the thumb of the government for too long. And we talk about self-governance, but how can you have self-governance if you don't understand your culture? That's what I keep reminding people, you know, and because we had our ways and it was workable, you know. It was about working together as a community. And I could see that incorporated into Sawat Mahulo, you know, as we got to learn how to treat each other as a community, not as individuals, you know. Oh, you're Sawat Mahulo, you're Nisqanleth, you stay on your part. Don't come on our side and maybe impose your religion on us. To me, it's about understanding of each other, understanding what community really means. You know, we have our own ideas of what community is. Don't come into my community if you don't have anything good to say about it.
Actually, tell us about that then. Like, how do you view community?
Well, when I look back at our culture, the people talk to one another. And the chief was there just to point out or dictate to all the people who's going to do what. That was all his job was. That's what the chief was all about. And that was communication they had with each other. Now we got so many different rules and regulations and policies, and it's really hard to work around it because we don't talk to each other. Our policies are totally different from the local government here, all the local governments, than the federal government, which is the one we're under. It makes it difficult to work with each other. They use that as an excuse not to help us. Well, you can't. We can't help you. You're federal government. So it's really a difficult thing. So how can you work as a community when you get all these policies, all these laws and rules and regulations barring you from working together? I don't think it was set up to keep us apart, but I think it was set up to kind of fail for us to work together. And that's the way I look at it. You know, people don't realize, you know, that we set up all these rules and regulations, and I think Moses was the first one to start it. And these Ten Commandments. Because, you know, when you really look at our bylaws, our federal, provincial, they all kind of seem like they're shaped around the Ten Commandments when you really look at it. Hmm. I always wondered about that, you know, because thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt, you know, all those are right in the Ten Commandments. And ours was simple because we had no written language, so it was just a part of life that we learned to adapt. And I think our people got along so well together, you know, as working as a community, they understood one another. I was telling that story about that one native in my grandmother's house. He took his drum out and he went and he sat on the ground there and he sang and drummed for 4 days and four nights. Then he came back in on the fourth day. He said, oh, they're all okay. They're all hurt, but they're all okay. And that was at Vimy Ridge when my uncle and them went over the trenches and they had the big battle. My grandmother got a telegram about a week or so later saying that, oh, they're hurt, but they're all okay. But how did that guy know? And I think to me it was that our family units were so close. You know, it's like twins. They sense each other, seem like they sense each other, what the other one is doing all the time. So I think our family units were so close back then that, you know, they could probably feel what the other one was doing farther, you know, even if it was overseas. So I think that's what it was all about, that little story that my grandmother was telling me about that little incident they had at Vimy Ridge. It's that closeness of our people, I think, way back through centuries, you know, in order to understand one another, because, you know, I think the chief had really little to do, but I think it was just the stature, you know, there to bless everything, you know, whenever they had certain ceremonies, and he was there just to be a head spokesman. But everybody, I think they understood their own laws, their own, what they were supposed to do, and the communication was always there for them, you know, so... And I've seen that break down in the last 30 years now. I've seen that communication breaking down with our people. Because at one time there, Tappan, Glen Eden, and our band would all work together. It was at a funeral. We all helped each other out. And whenever there was something going on, we all supported one another. You know, so and I've seen that slowly disappearing up. You know, we don't communicate with each other. And it always comes down to communication, you know. Mm-hmm. And we don't communicate with government. We don't communicate with our chief and council. We don't communicate with the city. We don't communicate with CSRD. We don't, you know, they claim they do, but we're there just to listen to what they have to offer.
Yeah, that's their idea of consultation.
Yeah, I know, but one day they'll get it, you know, and maybe really learn how to communicate with us. You know, it takes a, maybe if we decide to take over all of Simon Arm and say that's our town, then what are they going to do? Because nobody talks to us, you know, and then everybody be up in arms, you know, and because it's that lack of communication, you know, we should be talking about what if, you know, woulda, shoulda, coulda, instead of that comes later.
Yeah.
You know, sad to say, but...
No, you know. You're right. It's the consultation aspect of here's what's happening, right? It's mm-hmm. after the fact. It's after the planning. Yeah. Like, the communication has to happen before the planning. Yeah. And I think that's what's missing on a lot of levels, you know, between Indigenous and settler government, but also just with neighborhoods, families, people.
Yeah.
I think we tend to dictate to each other.
It's something I think we got to really understand is how to really communicate.
So how, what does that look like?
I think it's talking, begin the initial stages of learning to talk to each other. And say, what it was like way back when? What changes can we make now, you know, for the good of the people? Because you see all the things they're having now down the coast, you know, about the people taking their title and rights, claiming townships. Because that's always the biggest fear I've seen, too. When they first started talking about title and rights, right away the local communities start, oh, they're going to take my job, they're going to take my house, they're going to take my car, they're going to take my ATV, they're going to take my boat, you know. See, that's what I mean. There's no communication prior. We wait until it happens, then we start panicking and start getting mad at it. Creates more anger at each other.
Mm-hmm. And then we fill our heads with the information that isn't true. But that's, there it is, right? We think it's fact now.
Yeah, and I think it's up to the young people now to start really learning each other, off each other, and communicating, you know, the Christinas, the other kids that are going to university, college. Start learning how to talk to one another to get a better idea as to what kind of a legacy they're going to leave for their children, you know, because we didn't do a very good job. I'm one of the first ones to admit it, you know. I tried helping save our salmon, but that didn't work. Keep thinking about our environment, but that didn't work. So what is the answer? And I think it's up to the young people to see what kind of a legacy they're going to leave for their children now.
Here we're back to this on-reserve, off-reserve culture and relearning the culture. Do you think that there's valuable things that people like Christina can learn away from here and be able to bring those things back in a way that's accepted and appreciated?
Well, I think it always goes back to that community living, you know, how to talk to each other and do things together, you know, instead of just a little segment of the community doing all the work. Whereas it should be community-wide, not just a little select few trying to do the work. Because you accomplish a heck of a lot more. Because when I was building a pit house, and people would ask, how long did it take to build a pit house? You know, a winter home? It took 3 people just about a month to build. But if you had 500 hands working on it, it probably only took a few days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the more people that contribute, the quicker it gets done, and you know, the satisfaction of accomplishing something, I think, is really important, where the whole community could say, well, we did this,
mm-hmm.
not I did this. Because that seems to be the route we go, you know, where a select few try to do a lot of work and a work of 500 hands. And it's really difficult because it takes time before people get the message. And I think that's where I always talk about community living, where we all learn to work together to accomplish something important.
So what's happening on Switzmall that you feel might need that kind of an action, where everybody's working together towards the same goals?
Well, we got the trail, we got the Mount Ida, planning on Mount Ida, the trail,
the West Bay Trail.
West Bay Trail, and I think it's too late for our salmon, because we tried the Salmon River Roundtable to kind of protect our salmon, and they're all gone now. And our water is gone, going away. It's a real important factor. We got to really sit down together and say, how can we look after what water we have left? Because they were talking about the Columbia River Treaty. And I said, why don't they divert it this way? Because the headwaters are in our land. It'll help our salmon and help our water problem. But then we'd have Trump after us.
Well, we don't want that. There's been a lot of discussion, too, about larger plans, larger environmental plans to try to hold more water in the mountains around here. Do you think there's some potential for projects like that? Like, I know you're talking, are you talking about, like, Salmon River not having enough water in it to kind of maintain?
No, it's overall. When you really look at it, it's overall. You know, our water slowly disappearing overall. Our lake level is down, you know, if it's down here. Naturally, it's going to be down all over the place, you know. Because my grandmother, when we took her to Kamloops, I think about 30 years ago, we stopped there alongside the river and said, Aka Johannes de Salskwa. She looked at the river there, Thompson, and she said, oh, where's the water? You know, she was shocked because there's a lot of little islands out in that river. Whereas when she was a young girl, there were lots and lots of water. Now, that was the beginning stages of us losing our water. You look at all the houses, the factories, everything just dipping into the water. All the farmers watering their fields, we don't think about, because, you know, we don't really think about the future. And once it's gone, what are we going to do then?
Yeah, water's kind of important.
Well, all our girls were named, our females were named after water. When they were born, because they were the givers of life, and that's the way our culture was looked at. You know, water is a giver of life. It tells you, you know, our people knew about water a long time ago. They didn't have a professor come and tell them how important it was. They knew. There was a lot of things they must have known, you know, because they lived in the environment for thousands of years, so they understood it. No, we just got our little reserves, I'll say, to learn how to live off that, and can't sustain us.
Yeah, and we've got a very short memory, like the settlers who've been here for 120, 130 years. We've got a short memory. We don't know how much water was here when they got here.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It isn't an understanding of the critical nature of it, that people are wasteful.
Well, you know, I think we might get to that stage, woulda, shoulda, coulda. Once it's all gone, then we'll say we should have done this, we should have done that, but how do we combat it, you know? And I don't think individuals can do it myself. When we did the Salmon River Roundtable, it took a lot of people, you know, to get any of the work done. And it was work with the ranchers, the farmers, and the people in the valley, and then up Falkland, up to Douglas Lake. And the four bands worked together on that. The Okanagan, five bands worked on it. Adams Lake, a part of it, and Nisqually, Splatine, Okanagan, and Douglas Lake. That's the first time the natives ever, I think the first time that the natives worked together as a whole, because they had that fishes part of their drive into helping one another. It wasn't about helping one another. I mean, I should have said it was trying to save the fish, you know, because it was an important part of our culture. Mm-hmm. Then you look at all the people that worked on it, you know, the farmers, the ranchers, the government, you name it.
What were some of the long-term outcomes of that, of the Watershed Roundtable?
Well, it was, I think it was the working together with all government levels. You know, we had DFO from Federal Fisheries. We had, you name all local governments.
So was that the first time that the local bands worked with DFO?
And any government, you know, provincial, municipal, and CSRD. Mm. So all local governments were involved. I think we started something that... As far as I know, the next big thing came out of that was the Fraser Basin watershed. So I think they used that as a model. And we kind of used that as a model with the trail roundtable. Mm-hmm. And started using that. And all local governments are working on that too now.
So you have built a lot of communication networks, Louis.
Well, mine was just a small part, you know, just talking to people. And I think it was the people themselves that did it. You know, I can't take all the credit.
But bringing those larger groups of different interests together to one place to talk.
Yeah.
That's pretty big.
Well, it's we did it, not mm-hmm. I did it.
Yeah.
I think if the credit goes to all the people that were involved in it. You know, Chai's Juto means I get big-headed. You know, I'm not like that, you know. When I look back at things I did, you know, with some self-satisfaction, I think, in saying, well, I had a hand in it. You know, it wasn't about me. It was about how do we work together as a community. I think that might have been the driving force behind it.
Do you think, though, that you being the pollinator of the community, coming into Salmon Arm, connecting with all of these groups, you talk about the model that other people and other organizations have used, but in a way you started a model like here, saying you had to get, and you know, back to the on-reserve, off-reserve sort of cultural revitalization and learning, you had to go off-reserve in order to start building some of these coalitions and people who are like-minded to create change. So you weren't able to stay on reserve to do that. You had to leave reserve, which is a huge thing because of the pressure to stay on reserve, like you know, the settler government ways of restricting Indigenous people to reserves. It was a big, big deal. And you and your mother, Dr. Mary Thomas, started doing that decades ago.
Yeah. Well, I think maybe that's where I kind of got it from, too. You know, working with her and both of us talking together. And I think we had a special thing between us, you know, to work together as a unit. You know, that's part of our culture, you know, is working together. Kanukan, you know, work helping one another. To me, I think that's what it was all about. And relearning of our culture was a big thing because she said it time and time again, if it wasn't for the culture, I don't know where I'd be now. And that's the same with me. If I didn't have the culture, where would I be now? I'd probably be 6 feet under like everybody else at my age now. Understanding who we are as Wet'suwet'en, I think it's pretty important, you know, that connection we have, trying to get people to understand us and understand who we are. I keep saying that time and time again. You know, we walked this land for many years and we understood the land, but when they put us on that reserve, they took that away from us. Because they are all our Kwisatzin, you know, all the plants, all the animals, all the fish, all the everything. Even the simple rock is a living being to us. And, you know, so people don't fathom that because, you know, they were taught a different way. And I think that's why we have trouble with our environment, because people don't lost their connection to the land. You know, the farmers still have a little bit of it. They understand, but it's mostly about what they grow. but they don't see what's out there, and that real connection, you know, with the trees, the plants out there, and the water. And I always maintain, you know, I'm bringing it up again. I think our 2 feet were roots at one time, and we broke away from growing up on the land, and now we're getting farther and farther away from the environment and understanding of the land and what it does to us. So that's what my theory is, and I'm sticking to it.
So do you think that when people grow up on reserve and go off reserve to learn and experience and then come back, it's because of those roots they call them back home?
I think so, because I've seen too many of our people coming back after a while, you know, and they start getting a little bit older, a little bit wiser, and come back to where they belong, you know, the circle of life, you know, is what I see it as. I'm a firm believer, because I've seen time and time again a lot of our people that got older, they came back, either came back in a pine box, or they came back on their own to come back to their home. And that's the way I see it now, you know, and for the majority of the time they came back in a pine box, and sad to say, but, you know, drugs and alcohol, which was never a part of our culture, you know, it was kind of imposed on us, and we were readily accepted it, you know, easily addicted, and that was the hardest part of our people, you know, the addiction to things that were not or alien to us. And I think that I could see now more and more of our people are sobering up, but it's still the young people that have to realize, you know, the drugs and alcohol is not the way of the future, and we got to try to communicate more with them. I always try to tell that. I tell that to our young people, you know, you have to get out in the real world, get off the reserve, and go out and learn a lot of things. When you come back, you have more to offer our people. And I still tell that to the young people, you know, to tell them, you know, our ways are changing, so you got to understand it. But just remember who you are.
So when people come back, when Sahuatmic people come back to the reserve, so Switsmulf people specifically, what kinds of things do they do?
They can't really make changes.
We've talked about job opportunities on reserve, that they're really limited. So how do people come back onto reserve if there's nothing, like no employment ready and waiting for them?
They either work for the band or use that, or they're retired mostly. But I think the call to home, you know, when they get older, you know, time to come home. And I think that's what, you know, where we belong. Because it's really hard to make changes when you come back on reserve, and I think I've stressed that before, you know, where people come back and try to make the changes, and our people don't accept, because there's a certain limit as to, you got to be more subtle, I think, in imposing something on them to make them start seeing the way has got their way of doing things got to be different. And I see it time and time again that the people are pretty well set in their way of living now, and it's hard for them to see any concept of moving ahead into the future when they live on reserve. It's really hard to explain. Is that the way they were brought up, you know, with the residential school and all the imposement of law on us to make that change overnight? And I think that, I still think that with the education level of our younger people now, there are going to be some changes. You could see that all across Canada now. You could see more and more of our young people going to college, university, and some of them working as lawyers. A lot of them working as lawyers, I find, and because, you know, they looked at title and rights and how they're going to fight government to get our land back and different things like that. But you see doctors, nurses, you know, different fields of them now. You could see more of our medicine being taught now, and it's cyclical, because I think our people are getting into the healing mode. And I see a lot of medicine practices being set up now, you know, with our traditional plants and things like that. And I think it's that healing process that we're going through now. So I think that our ways are there, but how do you bring it out with all the people, you know, is one thing that I always wonder about. You know, how do we bring back the real Tsleil-Waututh in us to fully grasp what it's all about? I always have that difficulty because it was taken out of me. So I say there's always gaps that I wished I understood more. So I don't really, that's why I don't really class myself as a knowledge holder or anything like that, because to me a good knowledge holder is one that's more wiser, more able to really have an answer readily available. Me, I gotta struggle sometimes, and oh, I don't have the answer.
Does anybody?
I don't think so. Because it's all taken away from us. We don't understand that, you know, because to me it's about having the full knowledge. And I really struggle with it all the time, you know. I wished I knew it all. But, you know, seeing that we were more oral, we didn't have it all written down. And it's really difficult now, because I think all the elders that are alive today are residential school survivors. My grandmother and them, they still kind of lived the old way, a little bit. They understood some of the practices then. And, you know, we all say, oh, I wished we had a microphone or a recorder. I think we all say that we could have taped all our grandparents and great-grandparents, you know, their knowledge. Because I had a grand-aunt who could tell all different kinds of legends. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not the same ones and all in Tsleil-Waututh gene. See, that was a part of the loss of our language, too, because, you know, when the land claims came in, everybody was running around with a tape recorder, taping all the history. And I find about 99% of them were all in English. There was very little Tsleil-Waututh recorded. It's really sad, you know. That was part two of loss of our culture and the old ways. Because if they were taped now or taped then we'd have a little better understanding of what they were really saying. I think because of the mixture of the languages, a lot of it could be misinterpreted. So I'm saying that I was wishing that, you know, woulda, shoulda, coulda thing always seemed to bring up. They should have been all in Tsleil-Waututh gene to get the full impact of what the people were really saying. So,
is there more Tsleil-Waututh gene being spoken on reserve?
Dribs and drabs, because people are relearning it. Because I could speak it a little bit, but I struggle with it. But I never spoke it for a long time. Like I said, 10, 15 years ago, I started putting some words together and completing kind of a sentence. So I kind of know a little bit of when I speak. I understand it perfectly, but, you know, but to speak it, I think I'd have to use it every day and every bit of my life, you know, really relearning the language itself. Because we must have had a name for every plant, every rock. We had a name for every part of the valley, the all in Tsleil-Waututh. Because if they're talking about something, they point at something. Because otherwise you wouldn't know what you're talking about. And landmarks is one of the important things too. Because our people needed the landmark to understand where they were at. It's like having First Avenue or 55th Street or a thing like that, so our people knew where to kind of go to get the kind of feeling of where another person is at. So landmarks were important. It's like now we need a map to in the city, you know, First Avenue, Second Street, you know, so we exactly know where somebody's living. Our people had to have a system in place to where they could find out where the other parts of the land, because all family units that traveled all over the land, it was mostly family units that traveled certain areas. Sometimes they traveled together, but other times they kind of split up. So these had their individual picking their berry grounds or digging grounds or things like that. So they had to all know where everybody was. Kind of simple, you know.
So do you think that some of those landmarks and plant names and all those things still exist? Like, are there people who still know those words and are still practicing the language?
I think it's all pretty well gone. Because that all have to be recorded. It's not written down. There are some. Nancy Turner done some. And other ethnobotanists done some of it. But they didn't get them all. Again, yeah. You know, how many plants are there?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I know that Splatchin has been doing a lot of language work down there, so a little bit south of here. But that dialect is slightly different than Switzmilk dialect.
Oh, yeah. I hear them argue about who's the correct version of it. Me, it don't bother me, but as long as you know, got the idea of what you're talking about, it's not the dialect, it's about the importance of the word. Is it similar? You know, it might be a little bit of a different way of pronouncing it, but as long as they have the idea that it's what they're both talking about is important. Not about who's right, who's the right way of speaking it. It's not important, but it's about the importance of remembering what they were talking about.
So, Louis, can you tell us some of the activities and things that happen on reserve?
It's like most governments, you know, they give you a free meal once in a while, you know. But I don't think I've really noticed any really change there. You know, they build a new home every once in a while. When you look back, I don't think it's changed that much in the last 100 years. You know, a few new homes, and our roads are all potholes, and government doesn't give us enough to fix it. Water is finally, they finally gave us water a long time ago, but there are a lot of bands that are still don't have fresh drinking water. So I know we tried a lot of things. We tried cultural camp, we tried farm gardening. We done Salmon River, had a crew on that, and I had a forestry crew, and then I had an agriculture crew. And then we got a unit crew, 20-man unit crew, but that was only temporary because there was way too much drinking at the time, and we lost that unit crew.
Was that was for firefighting?
Yeah. My forestry crew, they were doing tree spacing, and then my negotiations with Hydro, I was trying to get them to, because I was interested in our plants, I wanted to see if we could plant, because they were looking for some way of eradicating their weeding and what they call it, anyway, they're cutting down all underneath the power line. So I was talking to them about huckleberries, transplanting a whole bunch of huckleberries to bring back some of our huckleberry plants, and it would help with their brushing and weeding. That's what they called it.
Yeah.
Next thing you know, they start giving my forestry crew direct awards and doing the brushing and weeding under their power line. Mm. And that's all they did for 5-6 years. Mm. They formed their own company, and they were brushing and weeding for 5-6 years, you know, on their own. And I think that might have been the first company on, probably maybe in our area anyway.
What about cultural activities?
We have some basket makers, a few basket makers, not very much. Now, my work with the Fall Fair Association too was part of that. We had a booth in there displaying some of our cultural stuff, and then I put a few floats in the parade, and we brought it down to the fairground and left it out there as kind of a display. But that's about it, you know, really nothing going on. And I think they need a driving force behind them to keep them at it all the time, but once they get used to people telling them what to do and how to do it. Is that inertia, I think you'd call it, on reserve? You know, where they need people to tell them what to do, and maybe that's the way it's been going on for years now. How do you break away from that?
Well, especially when the history has been, they've been not permitted to.
Yeah.
And that history is held in their, right? Like in their bones, That's trauma. And so, yeah, it's really hard to... Speaking of the language, I think I've mentioned this before when I was working with a member of Nisqually who went to residential school in Kamloops about the language. And she was going to do some language work for us, recording it. And when she spoke the words, she said, "I still look over my shoulder because I still expect to be smacked for speaking my language."
Yeah.
After all these years. So there's the history is held so deeply in your cells that It's very difficult to initiate some of those cultural practices.
Well, I've never experienced that, you know, but I started one of the first ones to go to public school. But in other words, they didn't really want us to speak because nobody would understand what we were saying anyway. Mm. We're pretty well, English was our first language already by that time.
Because you actually did a lot of growing up off reserve too, right? Like you...
Mostly in, when I was in trouble.
But didn't your mom moved the family?
No, I stayed.
Oh, you stayed, okay.
Me and my brother Lloyd, we stayed on reserve.
Oh, okay.
The family moved off and... So just me and my brother stayed, and the rest of the family traveled all over. They were in, I think, Mission, then they moved to Surrey, then they moved to Kelowna, then they moved to Maple Lake, then to Enderby. Mm. They traveled all over. Yeah, I and my brother Lloyd were the only ones that stayed on reserve, and I grew up with my grandmother, and Lloyd kind of grew up with Mary's grandmother, and they got their own place, and I lived on reserve all my life. Yeah, I guess the changes that I made to myself, I think I probably would have been long gone by now. You know, the way I was drinking and carousing, and I think I quit 30 some odd years ago, and I think that made a big difference in my life. I'll admit, you know, if I kept on going the route I was going, I don't think I'd be here today. You know, because all the ones I grew up with are all gone, you know, and all from alcohol and drugs. And there are just a few left that I grew up with. And that's why the pain, when you get older, you experience more pain. People leaving you, you know, unexpectedly all the time. The pain was been there the last 30 years, 40 years now with me. And it's learning how to cope with it, I guess, you know, where you kind of make yourself stronger. Because I think our people are really not supposed to show their emotions too much. You know, we had to experience or learn to accept what was given with little, learn how to be a true warrior, I guess, and, you know, to accept pain and without feeling so much, you know, because... It's kind of like letting the enemy see the sign of weakness in you. I think our people were not allowed to show too much emotions, you know. Now that when I look back at my grandmother and grandfather, they never talked about the people who passed away. So I know very little about my grandparents, my grandfather especially. They never talked about who are his relatives, you know, and... Same with my other grandparents, you know, they never talked about them once they were gone. So it's like as if, you know, they, out of sight, out of mind, I know they probably do their grieving inside. And Mom and them would talk about, especially when all the elders would get together and they'd start talking about somebody who passed away, and all of a sudden they'd all start crying. And I think I was part of their healing process because they all had to get together, and then all the women would talk about somebody who passed away, and one would start crying. Mom would say all of a sudden all of them were crying, and so I think I was part of their healing process, not to show your emotions, you know, out in the community, I think.
Until you're in a safe space.
Yeah, I think so, because I, you know, one of the few things that I always wondered about, you know, it's really hard to, you know, how do I grieve now? I just bottle it up inside me. Let very few people see the pain I feel. To me, it's kind of like a sign of weakness. You know, so it's scary. How much can we take? You know, how much pain can we take without something damaging your psyche, whatever you want to call it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so. But so far, I think I've done okay. Still alive and kicking and still here to give you guys a rough time.
Well, I do appreciate that. I'm really happy that you're here. Thank you for today. I think this was another wonderful gift that you've given us to give us insight into how cultural revitalization can work off reserve and on reserve. And I think just building those communication bridges, like you said, is the key to moving forward. So thank you for that advice.
Yeah. Well, I don't think I'd have got very far if nobody listened to me, maybe. Maybe I did have an impact. I don't know.
I think you did.
Yeah, well, you know, up to the future to really figure it out. Because, you know what, I'll say that ASI up is yummy at the meal. The land is getting mad, fighting back now. People don't understand it because, you know, they don't fully understand the environment, you know, because they don't go out and talk to the trees or the plants, the animals. They don't talk to them anymore. Even I have a tough time, but I know that's where the answer lies, is understanding the environment. And I think that's the only way we could do it, is getting more and more people out in the land to fully understand, you know, what it's all about. Otherwise, it's going to be all gone, and we'll be there, the woulda, shoulda, coulda.
Yeah, we don't want that. We want to take action now so that we have all this amazing, beautiful space and plants and trees and animals that we have now. Well, thank you, Louis. Until the next time.
Yeah, I'm going now.
Okay.